Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerundaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing VHS 99, which is the fifth entry in the now decade-long horror anthology series.
Yes, what an illustrious legacy it's been. I mean, I like VHS 2 very much. VHS Viral is dreadful by and large. And then today's, I mean, the last one is a mixed bag. I was a little lukewarm on it, slightly more so than you, if memory serves. And then today, I have reason to believe we might both be relatively lukewarm. And I'm kind of at a point with this franchise where it's all blurring together a little bit. And I also question how granular you can really get with it, because there's not much that differentiates VHS 99 from, what was it, VHS 94? Was that the previous one? You know, it's not like, neither of them feel like mutually distinct time capsules, if you follow me, you know?
I completely agree with you there. 94 was the first one that really wanted to hew to like a particular period piece sort of vibe, for lack of a better word. You know, wanted to create a time capsule. And yeah, it was a super weird choice. Like, we're going to do one 5 years later. It's still the 90s, man. I mean, culture was not that different. And apparently, there's another one on the way, which is unsurprising. And it's not 2004, thankfully. It's 85, which I know is going to be a bit of a bugbear for you, just in terms of the 80s shtick being tired.
Well, I think the fact that the last two VHS movies have migrated to the 90s indicates that we're deep enough into the 2020s at this point that the 90s are now ripe for exploitation in the same way that the 80s were for what felt like an eternity in the aftermath of Stranger Things. So it's less of a, it's still a bugbear, but it's diminished somewhat now that, you know,
the 90s is beginning to supplant the 80s.
Yeah,
in
right.
The
nostalgia
mine.
Which is to say, the trendy old hotness.
Right. The one thing that gives me a little bit more optimism for VHS 85, which was apparently shot back-to-back with this one in secret, kind of an ex-Pearl thing, is that two of the presumably five segments, because they pretty consistently do five, are directed by David Bruckner coming back, and then Scott Derrickson's doing one. So
okay,
they're at least, not to be a prick, but they're at least real filmmakers, I would say, as opposed to these people that I feel like they've scrounged off of YouTube or some shit.
Well, you know, my favorite segment from today's selection is directed by Johannes Roberts, who I previously had no great love for. He did 47 Meters Down, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, and the Strangers sequel or prequel or whatever the fuck, Prey at Night. Not good. Yeah, I would say that episode, and obviously, or that segment, and obviously we'll get into it during the synopsis, but I would say I agree with you that that one's probably the best. But that's not, it's kind of a damning with faint praise, low bar to clear sort of thing. I think overall, this movie is still not nearly the disaster that Viral was. But
well, Viral only had three segments in it and a really stupid, like riotously stupid frame narrative. So that kind of sank it. And the segments were all, I will say this, 99 is definitely the goofiest entry in the series since Viral, just in terms of slapstick wackadoo kind of antics.
Yeah, it's just, it's a little bit worse than 94, which was already only okay. So that gives you kind of an idea of where we're at. Incidentally, before we launch into the synopsis, I have been thinking about, after you mentioned a couple episodes ago for Hellraiser, that we've been in a nonstop morass of mediocre to bad episode subjects. Possibly since The Night House, which I estimated was back in March of this year. We omitted a huge, obvious thing in the middle, which is we did Nope in July.
Well, and I think We're All Going to the World's Fair was post-Night House, wasn't it?
I believe so. So
yeah, I'm sure. I even said at the time, I was pretty sure we'd seen good stuff since The Night House. It just so happened that Hellraiser, A, put me in mind of David Bruckner for obvious reasons, and also just stranded me in that psychological desert of despondency. So I was having a hard time thinking of anything that had sparked joy of late. But no, there are always, you know, good horror movies coming down the pike. We've just had a glut of so-so at best ones lately.
Yeah.
And that is the order of the day, unfortunately. We open with a frame narrative, and the frame narratives in these movies are never anything special. This one is sort of funny. It might have worked better in VHS 95, actually, but I only say that because that's the year Toy Story came out. Here,
well,
we get...
I hate to fuck with you, but remember, it's VHS 94, so
it wouldn't work.
Yeah, it's right, just this. It's this series of vignettes, and it's funny because Wikipedia doesn't even classify this as a frame narrative. Mm-hmm. It says in the opening blurb of the article, "This is the first entry in the franchise to not even feature a frame narrative," and
which
there's
is not
an argument.
True. Well, if you mean that they fuck up one half of the bookend, then yes, that's correct, because it's not a frame narrative insofar as when it's brought to its resolution, the movie still has one in the chamber for some reason.
Well,
that
yeah.
bothered me.
Yeah, so it's a series of weird little stop-motion vignettes with little plastic army men, and it's just some kid doing goofy comedy bits with his army men, essentially.
It's sort of what I'd classify as red versus blue humor, you know, with like assigning the soldiers wacky personalities and having them bicker with each other.
Yeah, but it's orders of magnitude dumber.
Yeah, and they have a little bit of fun with the stop motion. Obviously, we're not going to recount all of these individually. Suffice to say, they crop up in between the bigger segments for the bulk of the runtime. And one of them is kind of fun. There's like a Ray Harryhausen-esque sort of
monster lion
cyclops thing.
Yeah.
But generally, the stop motion is nothing to write home about. And that's fine because it's supposed to be a homemade DIY kind of thing.
Some kid, yeah.
Yeah, although the voice sounds much too old given the caliber of what we're seeing, and we eventually meet the guy face to face, and he is like a teenager or thereabouts, but I think he should have been, and he has to be for plot reasons once you get into that narrative proper, but I don't think that was worth aging him up. I think that he should have been a child, and that might have given these segments a little more charm if it had been like a little kid's voice over the whole thing.
Well, just the irritating thing for me in terms of using it as a frame narrative, and that's why it's arguably not one, is it just happens to be a fucking other thing on a VHS tape. Mm-hmm. It's not really... I mean, obviously, with the first two VHS movies, it's people breaking into a house or a place and watching a bunch of weird VHS tapes. And to a certain extent, that's true with 94, but it's a little fuzzier. This is just like, it's just stuff happening. You know, it's just...
This one blank tape has just been through some shit.
Yeah. And then it's also, and you alluded to this, after the third segment, you've got the start of another one of these vignettes, which then just bleeds into the fourth segment.
Mm-hmm.
And we discover that the fourth segment, and we'll get into more of this later, but it's about like these four teen douchebags, and then one of them has a younger brother, and it's the younger brother who's been doing all of this army man shit.
Right. Who is not that young, actually.
He's not that young. He's just, you know, a year or two younger or whatever. But the frame narratives have always been a little tenuous in VHS, and often more disposable than not. So I'm not trying to say that this is letting down a proud tradition of VHS frame narratives or anything, but I think it's just, why bother? These segments didn't need to be there. They didn't really add anything. If you're not going to have a proper frame narrative, just Just don't. Just slap those five different things in there willy-nilly back to back with some weird, just random interstitial crap if you really want to. Like, at the beginning, it goes from the first Army Man vignette to weird commercial shit. There's a callback to 94, some kind of slap-chop analog.
Right.
Kitchen device food processor. Yeah.
Sham wow bullshit.
The masher or whatever the fuck it's called. You know, that guy crops up again. And then we get our first segment, which is about this group of, I can't even remember if it's four or five. It doesn't really matter, but like four or five douchey, edgy teens, like punks. And they're doing this kind of MTV-esque proto jackass slash just, it's just trash TV. I mean, it's just like teenagers doing edgy, random shit that they think is cool.
And if anything, it feels slightly too stupid for the era it's emulating. And that's true of basically the whole movie. The whole thing is kind of pitched at slightly too stupid for my liking. I know it was the era of Beavis and Butthead, but even still, they are very grating. And there's just shades of Bone Storm all through this thing.
Well, and it's funny that you say that was the era of Beavis and Butthead because, and I'm not a big B&B, you know, aficionado, so I'm not brushed up on exactly what those air dates are, but I associate Beavis and Butthead more with the early to mid-90s than the late 90s, which suggests to me that if that's the vibe, that would have been more appropriate for the last entry in the series, for 94, than it would have been for 99. But yeah, and the segment just does a little too good a job with like making these teenagers convincingly obnoxious to the point where you're just like, okay, shut the fuck up. I don't want to watch this anymore. This is killing all of my neurons.
Well, and that's how we felt about the Bone Storm sequence in VHS Viral, the Benson and Moorhead joint, where it was just these skater punk edgelords kind of running afoul of a zombie cartel, from what I remember. But they were, yeah, just hard to put up with.
Yeah.
And I didn't find these, they're in a band, they're wannabe rock stars. And I didn't find them quite as difficult to spend time with, but they're all rather disagreeable. And there is one in the group who's a little more put upon, and his name escapes me, and he's the butt of all their jokes. There's always a run to the litter, you know. And the four or five or six, you know, who
cares?
Who cares?
I think it's five, but yeah.
I think it's probably, yeah, four or five. They are going to spend a night, or they're going to record a music video in this subterranean space that used to be an underground concert venue. And then there was a freak electrical fire. And I thought that a bunch of people would have gone up in flames based on how they were describing it. But in point of fact, only the band perished that night. They were burned to death, but not before being trampled by their fleeing fans.
Yeah, so that's the thing. It's like, first they make it sound like they were burned to death, and actually then it sounds like, no, they were trampled to death and then their corpses were burned. Which is not really any less gruesome than being burned to death. In particular, I know you're a crowd disaster aficionado. So
yes, I'm something of a connoisseur of the form. I don't want to be too glib. There was a really horrifying one just this past month, like on, I think it was on Halloween night in, I want to say South Korea. But yeah, I mean, there's a couple incidents that this could be riffing on, and all of them yielded a much worse body count than just four people. So that did feel a little weak sauce to me. There was one in Rhode Island in the mid-2000s where there was like a club caught fire during a rock show, and there was one in, I want to say, Romania.
The documentary Collective. I think it was an Oscar nominee for that year.
I'm dying to see that given my strange proclivities, but I haven't yet.
It's very good, and I'm not a guy who tends to watch documentaries by and large. But yeah, that's like a nightclub slash music venue just caught fire and killed a bunch of people. And then because Romania is an authoritarian state, they have kind of covered it up. The documentary follows the whole movement. Anyway, this gets off track.
Well, point being, this all should have been much gnarlier than it actually was. That's why we went off on this tangent.
Yeah.
But yes, carry on.
So these teens, these four or five teens... They go into this venue, and I don't know, there's several false starts, but ultimately what happens is that the four band members, or five, this one was funny because I was absolutely down to my bones convinced that there were four women in this punk band that got killed, and then they became zombies. That's the upshot here. And there are definitely five zombies in this segment, so I really don't know what's going on.
Mind games.
Anyway, it's set up to be a possession thing. The right. Urban legend is all about possession, and the kid who's the butt of all the jokes talks about ghosts and something with boots or something.
He's brought along his 11 secret herbs and spices to keep the zombies at bay or whatever they are. And they all give him shit for that and start calling him Spice Boy, which sounds milquetoast, but I think, to be fair, would have been a much more cutting insult in 1999.
Yeah, that's you know, probably true.
If you want to be my lover and so on.
But it's just, they get torn up by zombies. It's kind of fucking lame.
Well, and they tease a possession thing where the four bandmates who aren't the guy who brought the herbs pretend to be possessed. And that's a little bit off-putting, and then it was just a joke, and then the guy who's the runt of the litter does not take it very well, and is like, it almost seems like it's going to become a we need to talk about Kevin thing, where he just goes berserk, and I was kind of rooting for it to go in that direction. I like when found footage movies tease some supernatural element, but then are just actually kind of mundanely horrible. You know, like it, just about a murder or about something relatively terrestrial. There are readings of Blair Witch where that's the case. And most of my favorite found footage horror movies are ambiguously supernatural at best, meaning that you could chalk it all up to just human malfeasance if you want to. And I thought that the guy with the 11 secret herbs and spices was just going to snap down there in the dark and kill his bandmates, and that would be the takeaway. But all of these vignettes, I think without exception, get very goosebumpsy at the 11th hour, even if they weren't previously headed in that direction, seemingly.
I think my least favorite thing about this segment is probably the fact that the kid with the herbs and spices gets cornered, and then he says some incantation and throws some of this shit at one of the zombies, and it actually works.
Yeah, that sucked.
That was super dumb. It's like, you have to do it one of two ways, and these two ways aren't even created equal, but either you have, regardless of the fact that he was trying to be vaguely respectful of the dead, certainly more than his friends, the fact that he came along, he's still fucked, or, and this would have been dumber but less dumb than what they actually did, he completely gets away or even rescues his friends with his dumbass herbs and spices. But no, instead...
Or he gets away and then winds up taking the rap for all of their deaths, which would have been kind of hacky but still better.
Yeah, but instead he just manages to take out one, and then they all get ripped apart, and then they get sort of cobbled back together, all of their various torn limbs, and then they kind of get marionetted into a musical performance on the stage. And it's like, okay, it's a possession there, except the band people are also zombies, so they don't need to possess new bodies. It's, I don't know, it's very muddled.
Well, I thought at first that the zombie rock stars down there in the burnt out husk of the old concert venue were supposed to be ghosts, and they were just being presented in a way that was overly tactile. So I was going to give the movie a black mark on that basis. And then they started making these velociraptor noises, you know, these weird little chirps, you know, and then I realized, oh no, they're actually walking cadavers. They were actually so tactile that I thought, oh god, is the idea here that they survived and they've just been living down there like mole people? But that's obviously not the case. Would have been scarier. Would have been kind of a hard sell, but is at least a scarier concept than what they wound up going with.
Well, yeah, and there's a little bit of potential setup for that too, in that when the teens first get down there, they find, like, a can of beans or something stuff there that makes it look like somebody homeless has been living down there. And
right. Well,
it could have worked.
It's one more reason to have a crowd of 100 people go up and smoke rather than just the band. I mean, I like the band being trampled because it gives one of the edgy late 90s teens the chance to talk about, you know, I like that there's a stampede because one of them has a line about like herd mentality, bro, sheeple, you know, or whatever. And so that's kind of apropos. That felt very like 90s counterculture to me. But really, if you torch 100 people in the backstory, then it's less impossible seeming that some of them would have survived and just made a horrible, debased life for themselves down there, you know. Yeah. But if you only torch the band and all four of them survive in this velociraptory kind of way, then that's ludicrous. However, the more people burn to death, the likelier it is that some small fraction of them might still be down there. And then if you want to go that route, you've opened that door for yourself. It has squandered a lot of potential here, and I'm not just saying that because I'm a freak about, you know, crowd disasters specifically. I really had my hopes up for this segment on that basis alone, and then, what is that, like, Futurama gag? The little, like, cockney orphan robot.
You've dashed my hopes expertly.
Or whatever.
Right, yeah, yeah. I didn't follow where you were going for a second, but yeah, that's apt. The one tiny thing that I kind of liked about this segment is that there's a bit that they splice into their video. It's like a demo tape for this band. Bitch Cat? Is that what it was called? It was something like that.
Credit where it's due. I liked a lot of the stupid names they came up with. The original band that burned to death, their label, I think, was called Mother Father. which tickled me. And you only see it for a second. They don't rub your nose in it. You just see like a little LLC or something, you know. So that was all on point.
But yeah, so the demo tape for this girl punk band Bitch Cat or whatever it was, They do one of their songs and there's like a bridge line in there where they all say together like, "Get off my fucking stage." And then later in the vignette, that line comes out of nowhere, you know. It's just it's said out of the ether, and then the first of the kids to die gets like pulled up into the sky and then rains down in pieces. And I'm like, that's fun. It's
corny, but it's clever enough.
So we move on to the second segment, which, as we were saying at the beginning of the episode, I think is probably our joint favorite.
Yeah, I would go so far as to say it's very good up to a point, and then it gets terribly goosebumps.
Yes, I would tend to agree with you. So it follows a college freshman named Lily, who is pledging a sorority, and she is engaging what is called a suicide bid. I think I would have liked it better if they had only used that term once or twice instead of like six or eight times. Like, okay, I get it. It's supposed to be ominous. The upshot being she's only bidding to pledge at one sorority as opposed to putting a few irons in the fire. And so if they turn her down, then she's a horrible outcast who cannot participate in Greek life.
Yeah, she's Quasimodo. What a disaster. Basically. Well, and it's kind of strange to me that every sorority on campus would honor that. You could probably find one that hadn't signed that blood oath. But sororities are ruthless. I don't disagree with that assessment or that dramatic reality of the tale.
Yeah. So she has decided to do this, even though her best friend / roommate is like, that's a terrible idea, because for one thing, suicide bids are just risky. And also, those girls seemed like pretty bad news. So I think you got the wrong idea.
Yeah, and there's clearly a rift emerging between the two of them because the protagonist thinks that she has a shot with this devil sorority, but definitely makes no bones about the fact that she thinks her friend does not have a shot. So it's basically a you're just holding me back kind of thing.
Yeah. We cut to a week later, the time and date stamp, good old camcorder thing in the bottom left for both sections. So it's a week later, and a Jeep with the top down screams into frame, and Lily is standing up in the back, absolutely smashed, drunk off her ass, with a couple of these current sorority sisters.
Yeah, homicidal woo girls.
And they collectively go into a crypt. I mean, it's one of those mausoleums where there's all the, I don't even know what to call them, but there's basically a bunch of coffins slid into cubby holes in the wall and then covered over with panels. You know, it's one of those setups. And they're regaling her with the legend of Guillotine, which is a baffling name. This is supposed to be a girl's name, and it's supposed to be a girl's name from, like, 20 years before and not hundreds of years.
I heard it as guilty every single time, and indeed that's how it is written in my notes, so this is news to me.
I definitely heard an N sound to the point where I'm like, are they, before I figured out it was supposed to be a person's name, I'm like, is this just like some dumb sorority chick who's not supposed to know how to pronounce guillotine? Like, is right. that what But
maybe
no,
she's born with it. Maybe it's guillotine.
Maybe it's guillotine. So ultimately, it's about a woman, a young woman, someone who is in exactly Lily's situation, trying to pledge this sorority, who, as part of the pledge hazing process, trying to get in, she had to spend the night in a coffin, buried alive. And the girls were supposed to dig her out. The next day, they didn't. They waited a week. When they came back and they finally dug her up, there was nobody in the coffin, alive or dead. It was just empty. And legend has it that Guillotine was dragged off to the underworld. And watch out for Guillotine. The upshot of all this is, okay, you gotta go follow in her footsteps if you want to join our sorority. You gotta go get yourself buried alive. And try not to make too much noise or Guillotine will get you.
Mm-hmm. And they've got like a Edgar Allan Poe premature burial kind of set up with a rope attached to a bell that the pledge can ring if she gets too spooked. But obviously if she rings the bell, she doesn't get into the sorority or any sorority. Suicide bid, you know the drill.
Yes.
So they lower her into the ground, and they don't fill in the hole. They don't, like, shovel the dirt back into the cavity, which I expected them to do. So it's just kind of an open-air situation.
I mean, they put a little dirt on it. Mm-hmm.
Just enough to kind of put the fear of God in her.
Because there's a cross-shaped, like, plexiglass window up at the head end. So if they didn't cover it over, it's like she's not even buried alive. She can see out.
Right.
So they put just a layer of dirt, thin layer.
We get some kind of The Vanishing style shots from inside the casket, which are rather nice. And she's doing okay. She monologues to her best friend a little, which I thought was overdoing it. What I liked, or rather very much did not like, being an arachnophobe, is when these giant black spiders start coming out of the dirt and scuttling all over her. One of them squats on her face. And then the worst thing that happens
is... They don't come out of the dirt, though. And that's what makes it even a little bit better. The sorority girls have given her a box. Now,
Oh, that's right.
My attention must have drifted for a couple of seconds, so I don't remember them giving her this box told her. But she's got this pink box, and presumably she thinks there's stuff in it that she would want to have. You know, like something to eat or just something to make her feel better. I don't know exactly what she thinks is in there. But yeah,
Capsule, perhaps? Like a cyanide pill?
So the spiders are something, to a certain extent, she has inflicted on herself. Because she opens the box and then out come these big, nasty, fucking half-tarantula-sized spiders. And they're just all over her.
And the worst part of all this, despite the fact that it's, hey, one spider down, you're one spider closer to having no spiders in the casket with you. She smushes one, kind of without meaning to, just in flailing around, and gets, like, a bunch of goo and a leg on the palm of her hand. And it's just, I hate crushing bugs that are big enough to produce an audible crunching noise. You know, it's like no insect or arachnid should ever be that big. The only thing I should hear should be like the smack of my hand coming down. No other. It's just unspeakably vile. So naturally, she starts yanking the cord, ringing the bell. The sorority girls up top, above the surface, are cackling, and rain is starting to come down. And this all has, I have to say, a genuinely pseudo-satanic kind of atmosphere. They even, the sorority girls, say this creepy incantation after they put her to bed, you know, after they
turn into this The Craft-ass coven for a hot second.
Well, that's my thought. I mean, we've only had two segments up till now. The first segment, the band that got burned to death, was visibly the Craft inflected, you know, like wannabe Firuza Balks, the lot of them. But these sorority chicks are way scarier and way more witchy than anything in the first segment. So far, so good. Now, as the rain's coming down, headlights come into the cemetery. There's cops trying to bust their hazing, and they start panicking and going like, if we get caught doing a hazing ritual, we're gonna get expelled. My dad's gonna be so mad at me, blah blah blah. So they all just book it, and then the rain comes down in a big way, and the cops are like, fuck this, let's get out of here. So now the girl in the casket is all alone. And this is what I meant in the last segment when I said that I prefer found footage movies that hint at the supernatural, but then veer into the mundanely horrible.
Yeah.
You know, where it's just, oh God. It doesn't matter at this point if Guillotine shows up. In fact, I wish she wouldn't, because this is so much more disturbing without her. If it's just a hazing gone wrong. There's obviously no shortage of hazing deaths in the annals of history. I'm not as much of a expert when it comes to that as I am to certain other matters, but I know that there's been plenty. And so far, this segment is living up to the promise of its premise in a way that the first segment did not. Here, however, it does get very goosebumpsy. Guillotine does show up. But first, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about this. Dirt and rain droplets and brown water start coming down through the casket. It is buckling.
Yeah, there's a tiny landslide, basically, into the grave. So yeah, not only is the casket beginning to flood with brown water, the lid is also starting to break under the pressure. Because fundamentally, this is not a real coffin. It's just really crappy plywood that's cobbled together in the shape of one. So it's not meant to hold up to the weight of 6 feet of dirt or whatever. So not only is she on the verge of being drowned, but she's also potentially on the verge of being crushed. And yeah, this is when, as you say, the segment goes off the rails because fucking Guillotine shows up. And you say goosebumps, I say spirit Halloween. It amounts to the same thing. Guillotine just looks like someone wearing a really dopey, zombie-ish skull-type mask. It's just really rubbery-looking and silly. She's kind of like, and bashes her way in. And then we cut to black. Next morning, like 6 a.m., the sorority chicks show up and they find a grave that is flooded almost all the way to the top. And they're like, oh, fuck, this is no good. And then...
I'm not a doctor, but...
one of them jumps in, like, we gotta go get her. Even though they all know, like, there's no way she could be alive. One goes in, comes back up. She's not there. There's nothing there. Ah, bullshit. Another one jumps in, reports the same. And they're like, okay, we got to get the fuck out of here. And they do. And then we cut again. And they each find themselves buried in separate coffins. And in one of them, I guess the woman you might call it the ringleader, is met by Lily, who is looking kind of corpsey and zombified, and she says, you know, I made a deal with Guillotine. She would let me go, but apparently not before you got kind of corpsey looking, but she would let me go. She would let me go if I gave her as many sorority sisters as she wanted. And so here you go. And then Guillotine shows up almost cackling like the Crypt Keeper. Yeah, well, just as a final note on this one, I think I would have preferred it one of two ways. Either one, like you were kind of getting at earlier, there's just zero fucking supernatural shit going on, and it just ends. They just drowned this poor fucking girl in a flooded grave. Jesus, that's awful. Or the runner-up, which wouldn't have been as good but could have been serviceable depending on how it's done, is they just turn the whole Guillotine legend into a self-fulfilling prophecy. Guillotine isn't real, but then they make Lily into a Guillotine by drowning her in the fucking flooded grave. It would have been purely mundane and non-supernatural up to that point, and then they could bring in the supernatural if they want. But they didn't do either of those things, so here we are. The Hidden Temple. Yeah. Yeah, it's a show called Ozzy's Dungeon, hosted by Stephen Ogg. Yeah. Yeah. But it's basically just a kind of sour milk version of Legends of the Hidden Temple, where it's clearly kind of exploitative and maybe not super safe for the kids. And the upshot of all this is we get down to two contestants who are trying to complete the final challenge, which apparently in the whole history of the show up to this point has never been successfully completed, because the ultimate... Yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure Who Wants to Be a Millionaire did have a millionaire in season one. So that's... Yeah. But anyway, the ultimate prize is you get into Ozzy's dungeon and then you get one wish that Ozzy, I guess, will make come true. But thus far, this has never happened. So the two contestants, there's this black girl named Deborah, I want to say. At length and repeatedly, yeah. And then, by contrast, the other kid is some doofy-looking white boy. And they have to race through this grody digestive tract. It's a weird... This set is kind of a weird mashup, at least when it gets to this part, of Legends of the Hidden Temple and then, like, Double Dare. Yeah, it gets into the grody factor. But anyway, true enough, as you would expect, Debbie is much better than the white kid at the whole game and rushes out to a big lead. And yeah, well, she gets into the final, you know, intestine or whatever, and he somehow catches up to her in there. I don't, whatever. No. Who knows? Just to set up the grody factor in the second half of the segment, I guess. So the white kid starts, like, grabbing onto her leg to stop her from getting ahead, and she kicks him in the face. And then, just as she's on her way out, it might not be the last part, but it's the second to last at most, she just, their fucking tibia, lower leg, just breaks full on in half. And it's not really clear how. The exit to this thing doesn't look dangerous enough for that to happen just from show negligence. And not only would it be highly implausible for some 13-year-old, 120-pound kid to have just snapped her leg like that, there's not even a shot that suggests definitively that that kid actually did that. In fact, the way this all plays out, we're meant to believe that that's just fucking negligence. I'm like, that's, I don't, make her blow out her ACL or something. Make it a little more plausible. I obviously, that would have been less visibly grody, and that's not what this whole movie's going for, but it was just doofy. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. She's just doing, like this performance that's all the worst parts of the Octavia Spencer character from Ma. That's perfect. That's a much better comparison. It's so terrible. At one point, she shouts about how all you white TV motherfuckers make my pussy dry as something or other. And I'm like, what does that have to do with anything? Why did she say that? But, yeah. No. Well, yeah, it's like one of those. I sometimes have the habit of, if I have a particularly weird dream that seems memorable or interesting, when I wake up, whether it's in the middle of the night or in the morning at the normal time, I like scribble some notes into my phone, like, I'm gonna turn this into a story or something. And then you look back at it, even just a day later or later that day, and you're like, this is gibberish. This is worthless. So yeah, it's in that vein. Yeah, well, before we move on, I think we'll just go ahead and take our break now, but we'll be back with the latter two segments afterwards.
And welcome back!
This is a very special episode.
Spend the night in a coffin.
Lily! Lily!
The faster you breathe, the faster you use up your air, so you can't panic.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
We have ourselves a winner!
And we're back. So, picking up with our story already in progress, we, as I indicated near the top of the episode, have the last of our would-be stop-motion vignettes, which then segues directly into the fourth full segment, which follows a different variety of obnoxious teenagers from that in the first segment. Perverts.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, just wearing the cut-off jean shorts and the tight tank top whole thing. Doesn't go to the extent of, like, dripping water on herself from a sopping sponge, but it's just shy of that. Yes. Excuse me, that's the DUI delivery guy, which was kind of funny. It was like Delivery United International or something. I mean, it's clearly a backronym. Like an iMac, yeah, one of those. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, things come to a head when aforementioned stop motion dork is out incompetently rollerblading in their cul-de-sac. You know, and he's got the full knee pads, elbow pads, helmet, and he's just barely hobbling along. And they're like, "Oh, bro, he's such a doofus." You know. But he keeps making his way toward aforementioned hot chick across the street. And they're like, "No, bro, you don't just go up to a hot girl like that." It's like, well, apparently you do. Because she actually, like, takes his arm and escorts him inside. And they're all like, "Bro, he's got game!" You know. And sure enough, shortly thereafter, he comes back. And like, "Bro, you actually talked to her." "Oh, you mean Sandra?" Like, what? Yeah, because she invited him over to help her set up a webcam. So he's going to slip in some spyware into that webcam so they can, yeah, peep on her more effectively than just having binoculars or the camcorder and shooting across the street. Yeah. That's, yes, that is fair. One little Easter egg that I noticed, and I expect you did too, because you're more of an aficionado than I am, but they were playing Resident Evil 2 on their CRT TV, right? Yeah, so at least they have decent taste in video games. But yeah, so they're watching her just kind of hanging out, and then she starts getting undressed with predictable for them reactions. She takes her top off and like, "Oh, dude, look at her tits!" You know, all this stuff. And then she reaches into her hairline and like, "Oh, bro, I knew it was a wig." Except she takes off her entire scalp. Snakes! She's a fucking Medusa! Well, that was the thing that threw me off at first, because the first kid she pounces on, she just kind of rips him up. And I'm like, oh, are they not actually going to make her turn dudes to stone? I mean, what's the fucking point? But then sure enough, the other kids all get turned into stone. Yep. Well, yeah, they're trying to summon some demon named Ukuban, I want to say. Fair enough. You know what might have been better for Ozzy's dungeon is if Ozymandias was down in the fucking the fucking cave, and then they get, like, monkey's paw type wishes. Right, right. Anyway, Ukuban, they're trying to summon this demon, and they're going to use this volunteer woman as a vessel to carry his spirit or essence or whatever. And instead, they accidentally release some demon with a really, like, a goofy monster henchman name. Fenster or, you know, something like that. And he's just kind of scampering around, sort of Igor or Gollum-esque, and they banish him back from whence he came so they could resume their ritual. And yeah, in the course of doing that, because I guess he grabbed onto the videographers or they grabbed onto him by accident or whatever, so they end up in hell, and they have to find their way out. Yeah. Just bad. Just Yeah. So Mabel takes them to Ukuban's lair. Ukuban apparently has a handful of cultists who are conducting a ritual of their own, sort of mirroring the coven on the earth side to, I guess, bring Ukuban into the human world. And their scheme basically is they're going to grab onto Ukuban when he's getting pulled into the human world, basically to take the trip back. Which sounds like an incredibly poor plan, but then again, they probably don't have a lot of other options. And apparently, you know, this is like midnight of Y2K. They're... Right, so they have to... The ritual's supposed to be completed at the stroke of midnight, and so they've only got like 8 minutes. So, granted, in fairness to them, they don't have a lot of time to come up with a better plan. But they get in this area, and then they're spotted, and at first it looks like the Keenan analog, to characterize him as you did, is pounced on first, and he's like, go, go, after he had given his friend shit for being a bad person. The friend, I guess, sort of redeems himself because he finds this stabby stick and kind of leaps into the fray and starts murdering these cultists and saving his friend. His friend, in turn, saves him from the last one. At one point, Mabel, who's still lurking in the background, they're like, Mabel, come with us. She gets pounced on. And she's like, write my name in the witch's tome, or whatever the hell. Yeah, equally, I would say equally inauthentic as Ren Fair. Like, a little too many thous, and I don't think she used the word hither 100% correctly. Just, you know, things like that. Thou art funky fresh. So they successfully grab onto Ukuban and are pulled back into our world. But somehow Kenan has ended up where Ukuban was supposed to be. His voice comes out of the woman who's laid out on the table. His buddy with the camera has ended up just on the floor next to the table. It's like, dude, we made it! Except then the coven gets super threatening and angry where they weren't before, and they murder both of them. Yeah. The only other thing I really have to say about this segment, other than it's just kind of dopey and flavorless, is that it inexplicably... You were talking about how the quality on the webcam was way too good in the last segment, and that's true. The picture in this whole fifth segment is way too high res. I mean, the other ones all look credibly like a 90s camcorder, maybe a little bit sharper here and there, but broadly speaking, a strong matchup for that. But this just looks like any other aughts or 2010s found footage thing. It's too high res. It doesn't look period appropriate at all. It looks like 10/31/98 or whatever the hell that Halloween segment at the end of the first VHS was. It's like that quality. It's weird. It's basically, the fourth segment ends with the Gorgon just kind of eating the camera, sort of getting close and growling at it. And this static shot at the end of the movie just looks like the camera kept rolling at that time. The Gorgon growled at the camera and then walked away, and then they cut back. And that's all it is. I think there is a bit of voiceover where they're chanting Mabel's name. But yeah, there's no payoff there at all. She doesn't, like, show up. Or... Yeah. Write her name in the book bullshit. Have payoff. No.
Hmm.
Well, I think the way to resolve this dilemma of yours is that you've always had a bit of a soft spot for the magician segment in Viral. Yeah. Yeah. And you get a certain amount of enjoyment around that. So I don't think the fact that that segment could have fit into VHS 99 means that VHS 99 is necessarily nearly as bad as Viral, because everything around the magician segment and Viral is absolute poison. Like the frame narrative, particularly the Bone Storm bullshit, it's anti-filmmaking. It's we're trapped in the negative zone when we're watching it. It's just awful. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it looks, this was the other thing that I thought about when I was watching the movie. Too much of the makeup work, or whatever you want to call it, the creature effects or just environmental stuff, looks like a not especially great haunted house attraction. And why? It's very silly. Creepshow has already carved out that niche. Yeah. Unless you're gonna do the Creepshow shtick better than Creepshow, and spoilers, they didn't. Don't go there. Yeah. 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 Fair enough. Before I get to my attempt at a recommendation, because I also don't have any really slam dunk ideas in that vein, this series has taken a weird tonal pivot that I don't really understand. I mean, I don't want to say that the VHS movies have ever necessarily been like 100% fully serious and dark, or God forbid that they have ever been anything like elevated horror, quote-unquote, or what we would call art house horror. But at the end of the day, VHS and VHS 2 are both pretty fucking dark. Yeah, I mean, that segment with the, like, Southeast Asian cult thing that summons the monster, that's some serious shit. And now here we just have, again, Spirit Halloween bullshit. And that appears to have been a deliberate choice. And it's not a choice that I understand. Because what they were doing before was working. And they were still, to a certain extent, even doing it as of the last segment. The last segment still had some fairly hardcore stuff in it. And to go just completely goofy with it, I don't get it. It's not a choice that makes any sense to me. And I can only hope that Bruckner, sitting back down into the director's chair, getting out of the producer's chair for VHS 85, and then also Scott Derrickson coming in, maybe together they'll sort of drag the series back towards taking itself at least relatively seriously and actually trying to, hey, you know, maybe scare you a little bit. No. Yeah. As I was saying with the possession slash exorcism subgenre, found footage is pretty well-trod territory for us. We've reviewed God knows how many found footage horror movies on this podcast and then recommended bunches of others in the context of those episodes. So I'm kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel here a little bit. I've already kind of given you the ranking of the VHS series. But just to reiterate, it's probably 2, 1, 94, 99, and then like way down under several layers of muck and bile, viral. That's very true. Yeah. But in an attempt to make a recommendation in the vein of a found footage horror movie that does some humorous things while maintaining some scares in there and some fairly good ones, I'm going to recommend Creep, and I guess Creep 2, you know, it's kind of a package deal. It follows the two films that is follow a titular creep played against type by Mark Duplass, who just kind of invites people to be his friend, essentially. He invites them out to this kind of remote house slash cabin out in the sticks, and he just acts like a fucking weirdo and freaks them out for a while and then eventually kills them. And I enjoyed both of those quite a bit. The third one has been in development for a while. I don't know if that's still on the docket or at what stage that film's development is at, but I hope it comes along sometime, because that should be fun, just like the other two. But yeah, they aren't anthology movies. They don't have a ton in common with VHS other than the format, the found footage format, but both worth checking out. If memory serves, they tried to do a little bit of that in 94, because the frame narrative there is about this sort of coven of witches who have collected all of these macabre tapes and recordings, but they're creating like an archive that's supposed to, I don't know, crack open the fabric of reality or some shit, and that's why it kind of goes off the rails, but it is similar in that... Well, no, there's that, but the SWAT team is investigating a warehouse where all of the assembled footage has been gathered by this sort of culty, coveny group of women. Well, it was kind of a weird melange of a Russ Meyer thing, but then also like a dime store H.P. Lovecraft thing, where it's just like, well, it's, I mean, just not in the sense of weird monstery shit, but just like the cosmic horror of the unknowable madness sort of thing. as opposed to the racism. Yeah. I'm Jim Smith, and we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you next time.
Apologies for the audio quality on Matt's track for the first 35 to 40 minutes. He had a bit of a microphone mishap. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from VHS 99 Official Trailer HD, a Shudder original, uploaded by Shudder. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, December 4th, and we will be discussing The Menu, starring Ralph Fiennes as a murderous chef and Anya Taylor-Joy as his potential victim. See you then.